evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Michael Fullilove. I'm the director of the Lowy Institute, and I'm delighted to welcome you tonight to the launch of our new Lowy Institute paper, Xi Jinping, The Backlash, by Richard McGregor. I see lots of friends of the Institute here tonight, and you know that this is the 10th in the series of Lowy Institute papers that we publish with Penguin and Random House. We started this a few years ago, where we thought that the business model of think tanks writing long monographs and then editing and publishing them themselves and then printing them themselves and then selling them themselves seemed a bit odd. And so we have started a great arrangement with Penguin Random House so that our leading monographs that are really intended to set the conversation and to influence the national conversation are available not only from our lobby, but also in bookshops and libraries around the world. They are, however, also available in our lobby, and if after tonight we have whetted your appetite, then there's going to be an opportunity for you to purchase a copy for $12.99. All revenue, welcome. Ladies and gentlemen, Richard McGregor is, I think, Australia's finest China analyst, and I think that this book proves it. We were delighted to recruit Richard when he returned with his wife, Kath, and his family to Australia 18 months ago, and it has been a terrific decision. And I think in 18 months, he's really affected the national debate and influenced the international debate on China. Richard is unusual in that he can stream together the financial and economic issues on the one hand and the security issues on the other hand associated with China. You remember my old boss, Mr. Keating, once said that he could stream together the economics and the politics. He was the Placido Domingo of Australian politics. Well, I think Richard McGregor is the Placido Domingo of Australian China analysts. He's the Institute's senior fellow on Asia. He has worked as a foreign correspondent and a bureau chief for the FT in a number of Asian capitals and in Washington. He's the author of some important books, including The Party and Asia's Reckoning. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Richard. So I'll ask Richard questions for 20 minutes or half an hour or so, and then I'm going to come to you all. So, Richard, why don't you kick us off and just tell us what your argument is in Xi Jinping, The Backlash?
Yeah, I mean, the title sort of, you know, only get a few words in the title. So I should say at the outset, I'm not saying Xi Jinping is about to lose his job. In fact, the book might have been better timed 3 months ago, because I think with the US and China talks breaking down, there's a kind of a rally around the flag moment in China these days. You know, critics of Xi Jinping have an even weaker chance to speak up at the moment because it's more dangerous at a time like this because there's a call for national unity. In fact, around Beijing, somebody emailed me yesterday, there's a whole set of new posters have gone up around Beijing with the slogan, stick to our mission or stick to your mission. In other words, all hands on deck right now with the big battle unfolding with the US. But essentially what I've tried to do is just to sketch for readers Xi's critics at home and abroad. Now, I think it's pretty obvious abroad there's a large backlash against China. Not uniform, of course, but I often think that the debate in Australia is a little bit skewed or a little bit parochial in the sense that, you know, we think it's just us battling with China, whereas in fact it's many, many countries. The US is the biggest of all, for example. New Zealand has got its own debate going. Germany and France have changed policy in Europe. Canada is in the hot seat on the Huawei issue, et cetera, et cetera. So there's many countries grappling with China, and I just tried to use four case studies, the US, Germany, Australia, and Singapore, to give people a sense of how each is trying to deal with that. So that's offshore. At home in China, it's obviously much more difficult to write about it. Information is much less available. It's difficult to get people to talk to you. But I think it's been quite remarkable over the last year, really since mid last year, the number of people who have spoken up against Xi Jinping. Economic policy in particular, and that's, I think, partly because economic policy is an area which you can, relatively speaking, openly debate in China. Therefore, there's been a lot of people having a go at him about that. Some long tracks by very prominent professors at Tsinghua University criticising his cult of personality. Pretty well-founded rumours about the sort of council of elders, retired leaders, also complaining about the cult of personality. Legal reformers are a thoroughly disillusioned bunch in China these days because of what's happened to rights activists or human rights lawyers. And most importantly of all, his decision early last year to sort of make himself president in perpetuity, sort of upending, there'd been this sort of incremental institutionalization of leadership change in China, and he's thrown that out. So in some respects, I've divided it up into, in a crude distinction, good enemies and bad enemies. You know, the good enemies are the smaller are reformers, the technocratic elite and the like. The bad enemies, which I think people have underestimated, come the product of the anti-corruption campaign, because an absolutely astounding number of very powerful people who led very privileged lives in the elite have had their positions totally destroyed, their wealth destroyed. And it's 100 generals, about 300 other senior officials in the sort of nomenclatura, and every one of those people, you can multiply them by 100 or 1,000, the sorts of people who lived off them were part of their patronage networks. And if you smash a large part of the political system like that, then that doesn't go away in a hurry. Now, I'm not saying those people are in a powerful position to pounce, but, and I'll finish on this point, but it also might help explain why Xi Jinping has not appointed a successor. Because if he did step down, he's made so many enemies. His family, his cronies, his supporters, his own networks, they'd be vulnerable to being locked up themselves. It makes the politics sound very medieval, but I think there's a lot of the president for life stuff is about self-preservation.
Let me take you a step back and ask you to tell us a little bit about Xi's personal story and his journey. And in particular, can you answer the question that I've always grappled with, and that is, given the very rough treatment that he and his family endured at the heart of the party, how is it that he ended up as such a party stalwart and such a believer? Why did he go that way when most human beings would react by moving away from the party?
Well, obviously the key to him is that he's we would say in Australia, a true believer, absolutely committed to a belief that that the Communist Party is the sole body, institution, set of people who can run China. He probably has a touch of messianic zeal about himself as well. He's the son of a revolutionary. He's got a touch. He's from an elite family, red nobility and the like. There was a great phrase that I wish I'd come up with myself, which somebody used to talk about change in Chinese politics, that the Communist Party had got rid of its scriptures but hung on to its saints. And he's a good example of that in many respects. Not only does he revere Mao Zedong, who locked up his father and forced Xi effectively as a young teenager off to the countryside, he won't hear criticism or tearing down of anybody in the pantheon of party leaders. Not only that, he also reveres the Soviet Party, Lenin and Stalin. So it's the whole edifice. And on the saints and scriptures thing, I think he's putting a lot of the scriptures back in as well. That's the first key to him. That's his life mission, an agent of history. And I think the second thing, which we're still learning about, he was appointed successor in waiting in 2007. That was the system then. He was going to take over in 2012. Nobody that I can think of said when he was appointed as a successor in waiting in 2007 that this was a guy who was going to come in and shake up the system. He was a compromise candidate between the two sort of leading factions at the time. So what happened? Why did he sort of come in with such alacrity and almost panic in trying to clean things up? The first thing is the Bolshoi scandal, which, if you read the official Chinese press these days, is treated as almost an attempted coup against him. And secondly, he appears, maybe by looking into the abyss during that scandal, to think that all the pillars of party rule, you know, the state enterprises, the propaganda system, most importantly, the military, were riddled with corruption and, you know, could cause the foundations of the party to collapse. So I think it's those two things, his concern, you know, almost near panic of what is happening in the party itself, and his sort of sense of mission, which is really part of his DNA.
And when you spoke about his cronies and his family, can you tell us a little bit about that? You don't read that much press coverage of his family and of, you know, what they might be worth financially or what they do. I think we heard, I remember we heard a few years ago, I think he has one daughter from memory, and I think she was at least he has a daughter who was at Harvard. I remember that under a pseudonym. I don't know where she popped up since. We heard, of course, about that he has a cousin who appears to be an Australian citizen. And
been hearing a bit about his family in Australia these days. I've never heard of that cousin.
Likes a trip to the pokies.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about his family. I mean, he's been throwing the swatch around on the corruption side. Do we think that his family is holier than all that? What do we make of the Xi's?
Well, yes and no is the answer, I think. I don't have any sense that Xi is like Putin. You know, he's got billions of dollars stashed in a Swiss bank account or wherever they put it these days. In other words, you don't have a sense of anybody who's trying to personally enrich himself. He doesn't have that as a measure of his self-worth. But certainly about 4 or 5 years ago now, as part of a string of stories in both Bloomberg and the New York Times, published a lengthy story about his family wealth, primarily his sister and the brother-in-law. And it added up, and I've forgotten now, something like $1-2 billion, which they tracked down and pretty much tabulated. I think that was hugely embarrassing to him. The way that Chinese politics works, everybody thought that his enemies had just taken a bunch of documents and given it to these Western journalists. He'd gone off the next day and written the story, whereas in fact I think it took about a year's research to do it. And what happened after that was pretty interesting, actually. And there was official Chinese comment about this, not just rumour mongering. A particular figure who was a financier to various leadership groups, who used to live at the Four Seasons Hotel in Hong Kong, was literally kidnapped from that hotel, taken back to China. He hasn't really been heard of since, but there have been on-the-record comments that those holdings of his sister and the like are being liquidated. So I think he's attempting to force a divestment of all these assets, and maybe internally, it's very hard to know how this works internally, that might be a good defence against his internal critics.
And what about the daughter? What do we know about
her? Well, the daughter is photographed occasionally. She was at Harvard. She studied Chinese politics at Harvard, amongst other things, in the late Rod McFarquhar's course. He refused to. He was a very proper academic. When I asked him about that, he refused to say anything about her at all, aside from, you know, pointing her out to everybody. We don't know what she does, actually. She's occasionally photographed at official events, US-China events. I think a much more important event, a person is his wife, who prior to Xi Jinping becoming prominent, really running the country, she was a much more famous figure than him. I think she's a singer in the PLA. I think she had the rank of a full colonel or something like that. She appears at the annual, or did appear at the annual Chinese New Year or Lunar New Year a gala telecast, you know, the most watched event annually in China. So she's quite a figure. And certainly as far as first ladies go, quite distinct and quite commanding in her own right compared to her predecessors.
All right, tell us about this international backlash. What has prompted it, and to what extent is it driven by overreach on the part of Beijing versus defensiveness on behalf of the West, on the part of the West, I should say?
Well, I think it's been coming for a long time. All the sorts of things that people are complaining about with China, you know, alleged IPR theft, encroachments in the South China Sea, human rights issues and the like, none of this is new. So why now? I think a couple of things. First of all, China is a much bigger, more powerful country. You know, if you think about it, when Hu Jintao took over in 2002, China had just joined the WTO. They had a military which was much smaller, much less capable. They were a much poorer country. When Xi Jinping takes over in 2012, all of that has changed. That's the first thing. I mean, I think in many respects there's a continuum in Chinese policy. They always wanted to do the things they are doing. Now they can do them. So that's the first thing. China is much bigger. I also think that Xi Jinping himself has brought some of this on, and I think there's a lot of people in China who blame him for this. You know, people say that he got rid of the old Deng Xiaoping policy of, hide your strength, bide your time. I think that was really outdated a long time ago. You can't really hide your strength if you're a country of 1.4 billion people growing at 10% a year, right? It doesn't really work. But he, I think, was much more assertive than that, much more decisive in taking decisions. You know, didn't just hide the country's strength, I think in many respects flaunted it. That's another reason why I think people stood up and paid notice. But I also think it's very important that, you know, Xi Jinping, the last party congress at the end of 2017 and the then formation of the new government at the start of last year, that he really put the political system, the party system, up in lights. You know, the famous quote, you know, south, north, east, west, the party leads everything. And so I think it really, people finally, realized that this was not just a competitor for the West, the US in particular, but one with an utterly different view on the world and political system. When you think about the US and China, there's trade competition. It's also regional. It's geopolitical. It's about technology. That's why we talk about a digital Cold War. And, of course, it's ideological as well. It's a competition between competing systems. And I just think all those things came together really at the start of his second term, plus the president for life stuff, you know, that's going backwards. You know, Trump has something to do with it. I mean, we can talk about Trump if you want. I think his utility is kind of, you know, the usefulness of his tactics is running out a little bit as well. But Trump also has had a big role in elevating this because he's sort of taken on China like nobody else has before.
Do you think that Trump is a hawk or a dove on China, though?
Well, you know, he's a hawk on trade. He's probably a dove militarily, you know. That's his general mindset. But I was going to say, finally, we're looking for bipartisanship in the US political system. It's about taking on China. You know, Chuck Schumer, the Senate minority leader, is always urging Trump, go harder. So I think it's a combination of all those things has really sort of switched on people to what's going on in China. I think Germany, countries like Germany and France are important. They once wouldn't have considered China to be a competitor. They realise now that it is a competitor. So countries like which have done extremely well out of China now realise that, the European countries in particular, in terms of trade, now realise that China basically might eat their lunch.
We had Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General, here last night, and he made the argument that Europe was starting to see China more in three-dimensional terms, that is, seeing the security side as well as the economic side. What about a country like the UK? I mean, under Mr. Cameron's premiership, They really saw a lot of upside with China. I think Mr. Cameron took on some offices after he left Downing Street that were associated with China. I wonder whether somebody like Boris Johnson, as Britain goes through Brexit, they're going to be looking for ways of hedging their bets and diversifying their relationships. Where do you think that might be their settling point on China?
Well, you know, without getting bogged down in Brexit, nobody has any idea. And of course, the Brexit takes up the bandwidth. The idea that they can do a trade deal with China and negotiate one at the same time with the US, I don't know how that works out. But I think the key with the most interesting issue from an Australian or Western perspective about the UK and China is Huawei. Under 4G networks, the UK struck a deal with Huawei that where the GCHQ, their version of the NSA, would check all Huawei gear before it went into the broader network. A great deal for Huawei. Now, Huawei, I think actually there has been a cabinet decision in the UK that they will replicate that deal for 5G. And of course, they're under enormous pressure from the US not to go ahead with that. So let's say they do stick with that. I think it's a sort of a legacy policy in the UK, and there'll be many people who are very reluctant to dump that. I think New Zealand would like to follow the UK. I think New Zealand is extremely worried about angering China, and they feel quite small and exposed. So if the UK deal sticks, New Zealand goes with them. Canada has put off a decision until after the election. Then they would have split the basically sort of old Western intelligence alliance, essentially. So I think that's the most interesting thing to look at. And it'd be interesting to see what, you know, Boris can have it every, Mr. Johnson, I should say, can have it all ways at the moment until we get up to Brexit. He can reach out to China. He has a great relationship with Trump, et cetera, et cetera. But sooner or later, they're going to be in a much more difficult position.
He is pro-cake. Pro having cake and pro eating cake, as he said. What about in Asia? Is there a backlash against Xi Jinping in Asia?
Well, I think it's different, and certainly, you know, Singapore is there's a couple of countries. Japan had its big fight, recent big fight with China in 2012, and it's only really now that the two countries are getting on a lot better. And partly that's because of the US that China has been cultivating. Japan, South Korea and China have also had a big fight in the last couple of years over the installation of the THAAD missile shield. China's not having the sort of massive fight it's having with the US with all manner of Asian countries. But if you think about it, the idea that China might take the place of the US, they have inbuilt conflicts with so many countries in Asia, territorial disputes with Japan, Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia and Brunei. Singapore has been in the Chinese tumble dryer a couple of times in recent years, once over Taiwan, once over the South China Sea. So in recent weeks, I think the Vietnamese and the Chinese coast guards have been sort of butting heads, if that's not a mixed metaphor, over attempts to establish various exploration sites and the like, including, by the way, the Russians have invested in one that the Vietnamese are protecting. So it's a different sort of conflict than with the US. It's a different sort of conflict that Australia's had. But I think the idea that, you know, China does not have many friends even in Asia.
That's a long-term phenomenon, but would it be fair to say that the heating up that of opposition to China that you chart in the book is more of a Western phenomenon, more of a North American, European phenomenon?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And if you look at Huawei, for example, Huawei is going in, the Japanese have said no, but you'll find Huawei going into Malaysia, Thailand, I'm not sure about South Korea. I think South Korea will be building it themselves. But for Southeast Asia, there's none of the sort of symbolic impediments that the US and Australia are caught up on, which is symbolised by Huawei.
All right, let me come to Australia, and then after asking you about Australia a bit, I'm going to go to the audience. There was a very interesting op-ed today that you probably saw from Andrew Hastie. Did you have a chance to see that?
You know, I was in meetings all the morning in Canberra, which is great because then I could avoid the media ringing me about it. So I haven't caught
okay.
up with it.
Yeah. Okay, so Mr. Hastie, who
generally
is...
Generally speaking, I think, you know, Nazi comparisons are a killer for any argument. It's like a schoolboy debating trick. You know?
Yeah.
So I don't know why you would throw that in there other than to get attention.
Yeah. It's a very hard-edged article, and to some extent, as far as I can see, Mr. Morrison and Senator Payne have, if not distanced themselves from it, they've sort of edged away from it. They've made the point that he's not a minister. They've said he's entitled to his views and so on. What do you think is the settling point for the Morrison government on China?
Well, there isn't one. There's no resolution to our issues with China. It's an issue to be managed. You know, I noticed in recent weeks just the flurry of issues which are sort of, you know, pouring rancor into the bilateral relationship. Swimmers and drugs, Papua New Guinea debt, the Crown Casino, South China Sea, Hong Kong, Uyghurs or Australian citizens of Uyghur origin, foreign investment issues. It's really been unbelievable to me that there's just multiple issues that we're grappling with. Mm. So that, you know, I think the Morrison government so far has been fine on China. If I had to sum up their approach, it would be, you know, do more, say less. And I think that's probably smart. I don't know how long you get away with that. But, you know, I think the Chinese watch extremely closely what the Prime Minister says. Mm-hmm. You know, they watch for signals at the top. And I think, I suspect Morrison is aware of that. So when he goes to the Pacific, he doesn't make it about China. When he, as I expect, his next sort of push in foreign affairs is to try and start the rebuilding process again in Southeast Asia, and he, you know, won't be making that, rhetorically speaking, about China. We saw him push back pretty quickly on the issue of putting missiles up in Darwin and the like. We'll see what comes out of his visit to the White House. But this, for us, is just a relationship to be managed. You know, in a way, you know, we can't have our cake and eat it too, but we do have significant economic interests which we should try and protect as much as we can, you know, not at the expense of security. You know, I find people talk about one or the other and not both. The other issue, of course, which I've been doing a lot of work on lately, is the issue of potential Chinese economic coercion against Australia. So far, we haven't been tested. There's, you know, some thermal coal shipments have been pushed away, but they get sold elsewhere. We lose a bit of money, not much. You know, a few cases of wine were left to rot on the docks last year. I think, as Hugh White said at the time, you know, China had barely cleared its throat and already people in Australia were panicking. Can you imagine what happens if they really did do something? That would really test us and the political system. And a lot of people who talk tough on China, you know, we'll see how they go.
One of the people who talks tough on China was Mr. Pompeo. And at the State Library just up the road on Sunday, he said he presented the choice pretty starkly for Australia. He said, you can sell your soul for a pile of soya beans or you can protect your people.
Right. Is that really the choice? You know, you can run your economy and, you know, I don't know. Well, it might be in the future, but it's not right now. I don't know. You know, it's certainly a good idea to try and diversify your trade away from China. It's great in theory. In practice, it's really difficult. It's really difficult. Everybody talks about India, but India is simply not the sort of customer that China is. Of course, we should do it, but don't think you can do it overnight, and don't think if you do that, it's going to be cost-free. So we've got to be pretty hard-headed about what costs we're willing to bear, you know, as we maintain the security relationship with the US.
And my last question is, what does China make of all this Australian policy? They were obviously unhappy with a number of decisions that the government made before the election in relation to Huawei and other things. They disappointed probably that then that those they won't have a chance at relitigating those issues now. How grumpy are they with us? What is the, I guess we're kind of in the freezer or we're in the fridge?
I think we were in the freezer. We came out for about 3 months. Now we're back in the fridge.
Back in the fridge. What is the kind of issue that could put us right back in the freezer? What are the sort of the red lines for China now, do you think?
Yeah, well, I you know, if, well, putting missiles in Darwin would be, obviously. But the, you know, I think China was angry at Australia over the, you know, the high-profile debate on foreign interference. You know, for my part, I think it's good we're debating these things and, you know, trying to come to grips with them. But they were doubly angry, I think, because they think we were kind of ringleaders going around the world talking to other people about these things and saying to other countries, you should look at this as well. Mm. Some people in Canberra say that happened, others deny it, but once again, that would be natural, wouldn't it? You'd go around to other countries and explain what was happening in your country and the positions you'd adopted. So I think those were two things. Huawei was a big issue. You know, it doesn't matter what we do on Huawei, China will be critical. For example, if we do take the decision early, we're sort of setting an example. If we take the decision later, we're lackeys of America. So it's a good thing we take the decision early on our own, even though that might have copped a lot of flack. The other issue I meant to remember about rancor in the bilateral relationship were Mr. Howard's comments the other day, mm-hmm. when he was speaking at the Diggers and Dealers meeting in Kalgoorlie. You know, I think John Howard is pretty well known. When he speaks off the cuff. He doesn't write down his speeches. So I'm not sure whether his views about, you know, being inspired by the Hong Kong protests and this is the future of China, whether he considered, had a very considered view on that or whether he just spoke off the cuff. Mm. But, you know, Mr. Howard, along with Stephen Smith, a bipartisan delegation, went to China last December. I was on that delegation. That was a kiss and make-up visit. We went, we did all of that. We had a laying on of the hands in Zhongnanhai in the leadership compound. The Australia-China relations were back on track. And then, for whatever reason, I'm not clear what it was, Beijing cut the cord again. So I suspect Howard's comments were, in some respect, anger at that because he put his prestige on the line and got nothing for it.
I know I keep saying I'm going to come to the audience, but Richard is so interesting, I'm going to ask one more question, and that is, you mentioned Hong Kong. How big an issue is Hong Kong for Xi Jinping, and how will they try to resolve it, do you think? Where will it end up?
Yeah, it's very hard to know. It's, you know, talking to people in recent days, there seems to be a suggestion that there was a chance, perhaps a political circuit breaker in Hong Kong. The chief executive could resign. There could be an independent inquiry into police conduct or something like that. That moment seemed to pass, in which case, you know, we are moving inexorably to the possibility of some form of intervention, which is incredible. You know, I don't think China wants to do that, but they would do it. Exactly how, I'm not clear. You know, you do get some people who argue that this might be, you know, Xi Jinping might think this is good for him because he can say, look at this mess of democracy down in Hong Kong and the like, you know, we're much more stable up here. But I think it's really bad for Xi generally. It's a difficult, almost impossible issue to manage. It could be a running sore. Hong Kong is not as important as it was to China's economy, but it's still important, particularly as a financial centre. And, of course, then there's the much bigger issue of Taiwan, the Taiwan election in January. That's a very unpredictable election. But what's happening in Hong Kong, I think, really helps the candidate that Beijing least wants to win, which is the current president, Tsai. So I think it's a bit of a problem from hell for China.
All right. Who wants to take issue with something that Richard said or something that I've said? Who wants to ask Richard about the domestic or the international backlash to Xi? Yes, sir, I saw this this gentleman's hand. If you could, so I'm going to ask everybody to, first of all, I'm going to ask you to stand up, all the questioners to stand up, if you don't mind, and then I'll ask you to wait for the microphone and then state your affiliation, sir, and your name, if you have anyone, and then pose a brief question, if you don't mind. Thank you.
Thank you. My name's Barry Catchlove. My association goes back over many years with Sydney University, and I've always been concerned about the almost total dependence University of Sydney and many others have on foreign students, and in Sydney's case, Chinese students. How easy would it be for Z to say to the Chinese middle class, we want you to study here, we're building universities, I understand, left, right and centre, and how big a threat is that to our economy, because that education sector is second or third biggest entity in relationship to China?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting question as to whether the first issue, can or would the Chinese government stop or sharply cut the number of Chinese students coming here? This leaving aside the issue of the dependence of the universities, that's another issue. Can they do it? In theory, yes. Just about 75% of the students who come to Australia come through education agents, so that in theory they can direct those agents not to send the students here anymore. Not totally easy, because the agent system, without getting too much into the weeds, has been deregulated, so there's a lot of people to call to tell them to stop doing it. Remember, the Chinese students who come here, these are the decisions of Chinese families. It's nothing to do with the government. They make their own decisions. Australia is not competing so much with domestic universities. You know, you can build as many buildings as you want, and they've been doing that for a long time. But building, finding teachers, building an education culture, that's something else altogether. So we're competing with Canada, UK, the US and the like. So what's happening around at the moment? The US is making it harder for Chinese students. Canada is in the real deep freeze over the Huawei issue. UK has actually reopened its doors again, but the UK has run hot and cold on foreign students. So, this is the fruits of Chinese success for the middle class to go offshore and get a degree. So it's a big deal for them to really cut down on it. And about a third or 25% of Chinese students who come here outside of the agent system and often from other countries. So you don't stop the flow entirely.
Do you think the vice chancellors have been unwise to allow this sort of creeping dependency on PRC foreign students, or is that overblown as an issue?
Oh, I think it's totally unwise. It's probably unwise in the classrooms themselves. It's probably unwise for many of the Chinese students themselves, who complain they're only studying with other Chinese. It's unwise in terms of a business plan to become so dependent on one class of students, therefore you feel you're under pressure to compromise and protect them. Absolutely.
All right, the gentleman at the back.
Quick observation, one is that you were saints and
scripture.
Well, Bishop Pope Francis said recently, what's all this fuss about being elected for life? We've got one of those at the back. As did the former National Intelligence Council of the United States, said, well, it also means you can remove. It doesn't guarantee anything. The question is, why is everything not your book, I think, in your presentation framed in always negative or increasingly negative things? Where's opportunity?
Well, if we get the political relationship right, then there's enormous economic opportunity, and there already is. But I think the politics overshadows the relationship, and it's not just Australia. I think it's in Asia generally. We're going from a period where the focus in Asia was on economics. Now the focus in Asia is much more on politics and security. So it's not just us. You look through the whole region. There was once a time when the American sort of presence in Asia meant that all manner of disputes, Korean Civil War, Chinese Civil War, Sino-Japanese relations, and now, of course, Japanese-South Korean relations, sort of kept at bay, and that's changing, because of China. Now, it's not necessarily China's fault in this respect. There's absolutely, you know, of course China wants to be the most dominant country in the region. That's quite natural. But it's how it goes about it that is the issue. And I think we're all trying to grapple with that now. So it's not just a great power returning to its position of dominance in the region. It's the way it goes about that. And so, you know, I understand what you mean about negativity, but it's the same in most Southeast Asian countries which are grappling with China as well. It's the same in Canada. It's the same in the US. Some of the coverage is overwrought and overheated, but the root of the issue is genuine. And in a country like Australia, I think Dave Sharma had a good phrase the other day, our strategic holiday is over, and we're grappling with that. It's a moment in history.
I'm going to take two questions at once. I'm going to take this gentleman and then Alex Oliver, the research director of the Lowy Institute. So if we get both those questions, just because there's a lot of hands and I want to fit as many people in as possible. No, this gentleman here in the red tie in front of you.
Oh, thank you. Michael Ahrens, in your book, I'm interested in the question of the level playing field between Western companies and Chinese and companies in China. And the very good comments you've made about the seem to be the Xi Jinping push to get the party involved in any significant company. And you implied that this was going to be more communism. In other words, the private sector was not to operate separately in any way. If you can have a party member or apparatchik in significant executive decisions, and this is going to be the big push. What chance is there of a level playing field?
If you could pass the microphone to Alex.
Yes, Alex Oliver. Thank you, Richard, and congratulations on the book, to a fantastic 10th title for our Penguin series. I just were talking about tumble dryers and freezers and fridges. I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about the temperature inside China, so the domestic backlash. I think the confrontations between pro-democracy activists, both in Hong Kong and some residents here in Australia, sort of shown that there are some PRC loyalists who feel very strongly and seem to be sort of programmed with the party. What sort of backlash is taking place with the ordinary people in China?
On the first question, I think it's two separate issues about level playing field. In many respects, two separate issues, and the party's role in companies. There's two different sets of companies. State companies, the party's always been involved and they appoint people. The big trend over the last 5-10 years is increasing role for the party in the private sector. We don't entirely know what that means. As often as not, they just want a presence there. It's like a political insurance policy. You know, I don't think they're running the companies. Many of the chief executives, like Jack Ma and the like, they're party members. But the idea that the party is this ghostly presence making executive decisions, we don't know enough about that. It might happen in some places, in some circumstances. It's not clear. And in many respects, that's a problem, because if Xi Jinping tells us the party runs everything, what are we meant to believe? We just take them at their word. And that casts a shadow over many of these companies. The other issue, level playing field more generally, is the issue about, does China meet its commitments under the WTO? Or as the Americans say, you know, the WTO is not fit for purpose for managing China. And I think that's a different issue. On the domestic backlash, I mean, Xi Jinping is not in trouble. It's often hard to judge. People say, what do the Chinese think? I mean, how would I know what the Chinese think? But it's also difficult. We don't have access to good, up-to-date, accurate polling data. But I would say that, and this is an extremely crude dichotomy again, that you might say Xi Jinping is very popular amongst the people, unpopular with the elite. You know, the Chinese economy is still quite healthy, I think. I mean, there's lots of weak spots here and there, and we've had more sort of financial brush fires recently. But if you look at overall incomes under Xi Jinping, they've gone up. So as long as that keeps going, then he's fine. But the views of the elite in many respects are what would determine his future in any case.
Do you still get those popular sightings of Xi Jinping? You remember early on he went to the dumpling shop and there was a particular dumpling that he ate and everybody thought that was amazing and that became the famous dumpling?
There's a bit of that. He would always do something like that at Chinese New Year time, make a public appearance like that. There's been, I think, you know, you're putting me on the spot here. There's been fewer lately that I can remember, actually.
I think I saw Michael Bohm.
Thank you, yes. Michael Bohm from The Spectator magazine, Australia. There have been reports that China has offered to refinance PNG's debt and is also making, of course, many hegemonic moves in the Pacific Island area. To what extent does this provide a serious threat to Australia-China relations?
Well, usually I defer to my colleague on an issue like that, but since I'm sitting up here, you know, I think, you know, we should, in the Pacific Islands, we should be able to manage that. We should be able to do that. Yes, China is a competitor there, but, you know, surely we can manage that. And if there's a bit of competition, then I'm sure those countries will exploit it because they're very good at exploiting their sovereignty and the power that comes with that. I think there are a number of issues. You know, one of the problems with the Pacific nations, maybe PNG is a little bit different. Their economies don't really grow, so they're not going to grow out of the debt. And so if we start putting more money in there, does our money effectively support their sort of budgets and servicing Chinese debt and the like? But my colleague will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think since 2016, there's been very few new Chinese loans into the Pacific nations as well. So the Pacific is kind of maxed out in that respect. Long term, I think it's totally possible that China might want a, you know, base there of some kind, whether it's in the American termination, the place, not a base, you know, it's not a base, but it's somewhere where you go, is quite possible. I think probably the biggest place and where competition between Australia and China will be most fierce is in Papua New Guinea. And, you know, I'm not right across this story. Once again, I'll ask my colleague about it later. But, you know, we saw what the initial story was that the Chinese had been called in to give, this is not just to give money, but actual advice, you know, IMF-style advice on management of public debt. And I saw a statement from the Papua New Guinea Prime Minister today who seemed to play that down. So we've got to let it unfold. But PNG is extremely difficult to manage, but we have a massive head start there. I think we have a lot of goodwill. We have soft power there. Australia's problem is we look at this and we have a flurry of activity, then we forget about it. Morrison hasn't been doing that to his credit, but this is our attention span has to, you know, extend much further into the future than it has in the past.
I'd also commend, Michael, an op-ed in Today's Australian by Jonathan Pryke, who's sitting right in front of you, about exactly this issue. Hamish, I'm going to go to Hamish on the end there, yes? Not on the end, there he is.
Oh, Hamish McDonald, freelance writer. Could you tell us a bit about the personal dynamic between Xi Jinping and Donald Trump and how it's perceived in China? I mean, Trump flatters Xi, calls it a beautiful friendship and so on, and then turns around and kicks him in the slat with a tariff rise and so on. Is this losing face for Xi, or is Trump playing it very deftly? And what are Chinese saying about all of this?
Well, Trump, you know, was a bit of a cult figure in China on two levels, two contradictory levels, I would say. The first, you know, I think in the Chinese media, he was the people highly entertaining figure. You know, they enjoyed seeing him come along and smash everything around him in conventions and this, that, and the other. Chinese liberals, smaller liberals, also really liked Trump for a while. because of how he destabilized Xi and the like. He was, you know, they considered him a strategic genius because of, you know, what he did, you know, profess friendship one moment, put a tariff on the next. People do say that both Trump and Xi, you know, Trump would say persistently, yeah, my good friend Xi Jinping. People said that Xi Jinping said exactly the same, yeah, my good friend Donald Trump. But I think since May, when effectively the trade negotiations broke down or broke down substantively, that's all gone. Trump himself said, I think recently, maybe we're not such good friends anymore. And I think the Chinese system generally has woken up to Trump. It's pointless negotiating with him. You might give him something, he'll be back for more in the next couple of weeks. So I think the Trump-Xi bromance has peaked and is on the decline.
Speaking of bromances, what about the relationship between Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un?
Yes, well, I think that's evolving. I mean, initially it took them about 2 years before Kim Jong-un came to Beijing. The Chinese were furious at him on a number of levels, most, you know, obviously for what they would regard as destabilizing behavior in conducting numerous nuclear tests. He didn't consult at all with the Chinese along the way. The Chinese, of course, have little respect for a 33-year-old hereditary leader. You know, you're meant to do your time in China. Even Xi Jinping did his time in the provinces and worked his way up. They respect age and experience, which little Kim, obviously doesn't have. Since then, you know, the two countries or the two systems have made up. I think the Chinese probably think they have North Korea really where they want now. In other words, the North Koreans will consult with China and act more in concert with them. I'm sure that Kim will upset the Chinese again at some stage. I mean, we do forget that, you know, they used to say the North Koreans and the Chinese as close as lips and teeth. Obviously, that's nonsense. The North Koreans are hostile to just about everybody. One reason why the North Koreans want to talk to the US, and maybe the North Koreans would like US troops to stay in Korea, is a hedge against China itself. You know, they don't trust the Chinese and they don't want to be beholden to them.
All right, I'm going to take two final questions, and I'm going to take Sarosh Badaliwala, and then I'm going to take the lady over there. I'm sorry to others whom I missed. There was a lot of demand tonight. We need to finish on time, so we're going to take two questions. Sorry, sir.
Okay, thank you. I want to get your thoughts on the social scoring system in China. Is it just a bit of business as usual taken up another level, or is it of an Orwellian nature? Because it seems pretty similar to a 1984 scenario when you take that and AI. And given that that's a system which is aimed, I suppose, at controlling the society and maintaining loyalty, it's also, in some respects, the antithesis of building trust. And its tentacles are what's, I think, spreading into the foreign influence debate as well. So I'd just be interested in your opinion on that.
Thank you very much, Robin Fitzsimons. Like the first questioner, I also have a past and ongoing history with Sydney University. Thank you. I very much share your views, by the way, on the lack of wisdom of such emphasis on the proportion of Chinese students. But having said that, what is the evidence, if any, that this very large Chinese student diaspora, not only in Australia but in the rest of the Western world, changed their views at all on the West and indeed take on some of their own recent history, such as Tiananmen Square, and take that back to China with them? Or do they, and is that a good thing, or do they, as far as we know, retain their original perspectives on the world?
All right, and just to keep you on your toes, I'm going to take one more question from this gentleman, if you still want to ask it, because he looks so disappointed. His face fell when I didn't go to him. So if you can ask a quick question, then Richard will answer all three.
It's David Feckling from Bloomberg. I was wanting to ask about We saw Donald Trump complain about the sort of fentanyl issue, this opiate, recently. And I think one of the issues that baffles me around fentanyl is that it's a sort of needless irritant in the US-China relationship, and China persistently fails to deal with it. And where this relates to Xi is I was wondering where does the power lie in China, essentially? Does Xi rule China with an iron fist, or is he dancing on the heads of snakes and, you know, at the mercy of local and provincial officials and unable to do these sorts of things?
Excellent last question.
Okay, so there's three big issues I'm going to have to summarise. The social credit system that you talk about is being, you know, trialled in a few places, cities and provinces. It doesn't cover the whole country. I think you're right. It speaks of a low-trust society, but I do think that many other countries would use similar tools, although not to the extent of China. And this is one way that China uses the internet. The internet is far from being undermining the government, is a windfall in terms of, you know, digital data. It's like a real-time, the three big companies, real-time, privately-run digital intelligence service. And while it's not quite at the dimensions that many people suggest it is or you see reported, you know, like I saw one thing today at the Shanghai Railway Station, everybody being having to give their saliva for a DNA database. But I might say there is, you know, China also does have, and it's nascent and not as powerful as here, and not as big as here, a push, you know, a debate about privacy. Some companies have got in trouble for various breaches of privacy. But, you know, if you think about we're grappling with Facebook in China, it's much more difficult to push back. So it's, yeah, I think it, you know, it's on the way if they can do it. On students, do they change their views? There's no, I'm not so, I wouldn't be so much about worry or think about them finding out or not finding out about 1989. It's more about whether they, you know, imbibe or internalise a sort of democratic culture. It's very hard for me to say about that. You know, I suspect most of them, I don't want to overgeneralise, you know, understand which side of their bread is buttered. There's no upside for them going back to China and being political activists. China itself is obviously very aware of this possibility, hence their involvement with the students' associations and levels of surveillance of students here or getting the students to watch each other. So in that respect, the foreign education might have been very successful, the government, because they get a whole bunch of highly skilled people, but not politicised people, as they might have feared. On Xi Jinping, I mean, nobody is ever in complete control of a country like that. You know, one reason I think, you know, why is Xi, why has he been a much more authoritarian leader, even though China is manifestly a successful country, people are richer. And I think it's, in some ways, the digital data again. Once they sort of had a sense of what's going on in the country, and now they really know, and it worries them. Now, could they, for example, to take your question about fentanyl, obviously that's demand-driven from the States, so it's not just China, but, you know, when China wants to crack down on something like Falun Gong, they can do it. So I think if they really focused on this, they could, but they probably don't think that's probably not a priority. They're doing all manner of other things, have all manner of other issues to look at. They can sort of pick off people exporting fentanyl occasionally. I'm not sure I'd buy into the conspiracy theory that they're happy for it to go over there and weaken big bad America. But I just suspect as a priority issue for local officials, it's relatively low on the pecking order.
Ladies and gentlemen, you can see that I didn't exaggerate about Richard's strengths. We've thrown everything at him, from opiates to students to, you know, intermediate range missiles, and he's battered them back like Stephen Smith. So I'm comparing him to all sorts of historic figures this evening.
Too much.
I want to congratulate Richard on a really terrific book. I urge you to purchase the book. You can buy it tonight from my colleagues, and if you're lucky, Richard will sign it. I want to congratulate him on writing it, but I also want to congratulate the team that produced it. Hilary said that it takes a village to raise a child. It certainly takes an institute to put out a Lowy Institute paper, and from Sam Roggeveen, the editor of the Lowy Institute papers, Alex Oliver, our research director, Lydia Papandreou, our research editor, our events colleagues, Andrea and Sophia and Labs and others who put on the events, our media colleagues, Erin Bassett, who helps us to market the books. It's really a whole of institute effort. So thank you to everybody who worked on that, but particular congratulations to Richard McGregor. And finally, before you go, can I put in an ad for an event? We mentioned Hong Kong tonight. We have with us in the room Ben Bland, who's one of the world's leading experts on Hong Kong, as well as Southeast Asia, who's been all over the press in the last few weeks about what's happening in Hong Kong. On the 15th of August, we will have a panel discussion chaired, I think, by Ben with some other experts on where Hong Kong will end up. So if Richard has whetted your appetite, Ben will sate it. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us tonight, and please join me in thanking Richard McGregor.